Kurds bring in Ukrainian flags, pupils wore fundraising for Ukraine. I remember one of the case studies that I came across in the Cage Report was where students were fundraising for Palestine. They were reprimanded because they were told you should be fundraising for both sides, for victims in Israel and Palestine, where I can imagine if any student raised the fact that we should be fundraising for Russia as well as Ukraine, they would probably receive a sanction for that.
This report about schools staging events and activities in support of the conflict in Ukraine.
A survey by Cage shows that 96% of British schools have proactively engaged with the calls to support for Ukraine. The figures are in stark comparison to the treatment of Palestine last year, where pupils and staff were treated punitively for attempting to express solidarity. 80 survey responses mentioned schools promoting motifs of the Ukraine flag, such as encouraging children to wear blue and yellow for non-uniform days or hoisting the Ukraine flag on school grounds. The openness with schools have expressed forceful solidarity with Ukraine belies the excuses that pupils and parents, largely Muslim, were subject to by schools last year to justify ignoring the war on Gaza. Indeed, some respondents spoke to this disparity in explicit terms. The school organized the collection for Ukraine, but we were unable to do the same for Palestine as it was, quote, political as it was due to religion. We asked to do an assembly or put posters up and fundraise for Palestine, and they said no, but they're doing it all for Ukraine. But the Cage research also uncovered two further worrying findings. The first is that the government has been encouraging teachers to use resources on disinformation via the website Educate Against Hate. One resource was titled Be Internet Citizens, developed as a collaboration between YouTube and the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, the ISD. ISD is a strongly Zionist organization which has been heavily involved in counter-extremism work and is funded by major NATO states and by regime change foundations. The second finding is that some schools may have been directly encouraging support for armed violence in Ukraine and actively involved in supporting Nazi-adjacent Ukrainian groups. A key instance has been support for the Association of Ukrainians in Great Britain, the AUGB, the largest representative group for Ukrainians in the country. But the AUGB has direct and explicit links to the Ukrainian far right, stretching back to its inception. These include the ultra-nationalist fascist organization, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, the OUN, and its paramilitary organization, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, the UPA, as well as regularly celebrating a notorious leader of the OUN, Stepan Bandera. These developments are a direct encouragement of far-right, indeed Nazi ideology in British schools, encouraging a hostile environment for Muslim, Palestinians and other people of colour.
David, the Institute for Strategic Dialogue sounds innocuous enough, doesn't it? I mean, can you explain what it's up to here?
Well, the ISD is a really quite large organisation for a think tank. It was founded by Lord Weidenfeld, who, of course, famously served in the first Israeli government back in the day and then came to Britain and has funded a huge number of Zionist think tanks and lobby groups over the years. He's now dead, but the group continues to be strongly Zionist and the people in charge of it remain strongly Zionist and fund other key Zionist organisations. But it's also involved in doing work on disinformation. Now, what it means by disinformation is information which is critical of Western foreign policy. And you can see the kind of straight connection there is between that and its work on Ukraine or Russia and its funders. It's funded by something like six or seven different NATO states, yeah, as well as by a whole range of regime change fundraisers, including the Soros foundations. And it's engaged, you know, pretty straightforwardly in propaganda, by which it says anyone who tells the truth about what's happening in Ukraine is actually just regurgitating Russian propaganda. So it's itself a propagandist body, and it should have nothing to do with the Department for Education. It shouldn't be having its work recommended. It's actually an active propaganda organisation.
Mm. Well, I also asked Fahad what he thought about schools allowing support for Ukraine but vetoing kids mentioning Palestine, and what he thought the reasons were for the double standards.
There is definitely a double standard at play here between the Israel-Palestine and Russia-Ukraine conflict. Any child can see that. Straight away, we've had reports of questioning their schools as to why there was a double standard. When they were asked to bring in Ukrainian flags, they remembered what happened when they brought in Palestinian flags, and they raised that with their schools. Parents raised it with the schools as well.
David, tell us about this far-right Ukrainian group that seems to be infiltrating some British schools.
Well, I mean, this was one of the extraordinary findings, I thought, of the CAGE research, is that some schools are actually going directly to this Association of Ukrainians in Great Britain, in existence since 1946, and seeming to have a very, very long history with the Ukrainian far-right, you know, back to the time of Stepan Bandera, the big hero of the Azov Battalion, etc., of today. And so it's extraordinary to see that, to see that there seems to be no due diligence. The schools that have engaged in this, no due diligence. They're actually actively engaging with Nazi and Nazi-adjacent organisations and ideas in British schools, which must be against the law. And secondly, also engaged as a result of that in building support for sending money to support the armed conflict, directly to support military equipment. Like, which cannot be right. I mean, we imagine if people were doing the same, saying we should be raising money to buy military equipment for Hamas.
Indeed.
Now, of course, that would be a completely different matter, actually, in terms of resistance to the Israeli occupation. But we see this with Ukraine that there's literally no criticism of the idea that we might directly support armed violence from schools, including primary schools. Extraordinary.
No, indeed. And just remind us very briefly about the atrocities that Stepan Bandera perpetrated.
So Bandera was the leader of the Ukrainian nationalists, the proto-Nazis, who collaborated with the Germans when they occupied part of what was then Ukraine, and was involved in pogroms against the Jews and indeed against Poles and travellers, gypsy travellers as well. At the time, hundreds of thousands of people died.
Yes.
And these people, that's right. And these people were pursued by the Soviets up until 1959. It wasn't until 1959 that they were eventually eliminated, and to use the phrase of today, denazified.
Sure. Well. Finally, I asked Fahad what he thought the government and the courts should be doing about these worrying trends.
The problem, I guess, is the government itself. I mean, the government has its own political position, and let's not be naive. That's not going to change in the short term, or possibly even the medium term. So as long as the government's got its agenda, it's going to try to propagate that as much as it can. And when it comes to schools, what it cannot do is force those schools to adopt that position. And we hope that through this litigation that we made that clear, and the new guidance that was issued in the midst of the litigation offers a more nuanced approach and specifically excludes from its examples of extreme political positions that schools should not engage with those organizations that publicly reject Israel's right to exist.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, as unfortunately we're out of time again. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم فألقى موسى عصاه فإذا هي تلقف ما يأفكون
Then Moses threw his staff, and at once it devoured what they falsified.
فَأُلْقِيَ السَّحَرَةُ سَاجِدِينَ
So the magicians fell down in prostration to Allah.
قَالُوا آمَنَّا بِرَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ
They said, we have believed in the Lord of the worlds.
رَبِّ مُوسَى وَهَارُونَ
The Lord of Moses and Aaron.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing these verses of chapter Shu'ara. فَأَلْقَى مُوسَى عَصَاهُ فَإِذَا هِيَ تَلْقَفُ مَا يَأْفِكُونَ فَأُلْقِيَ السَّحَرَةُ سَاجِدِينَ Then Moses cast down his rod, and when behold, it swallowed up that which they falsely displayed. Then the sorcerers were flung prostrate. قَالُوا آمَنَّا بِرَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ رَبِّ مُوسَى هَارُونَ They said, We believe in the Lord of the worlds, the Lord of Moses and Aaron. So as we explained earlier, the magicians, the sorcerers, were the ones to start in that gathering. They wanted to prove that they are the strongest, that they cast down their ropes and their rods, and they were sure that by Pharaoh's dignity, they will be victorious over Moses and his brother Aaron. But when Moses cast down his rod and it swallowed up whatever they had cast down already, these sorcerers believed and they knew that they are the best in magic and this is something beyond magic. That is why they believed in the power of another Lord, the Lord of the universe, the absolute cause in that exact time. فَأُلْقِيَ السَّحَرَةُ سَاجِدِينَ This fa means immediately after they came into their senses, they realized, they came into belief. And it is interesting that the Holy Quran uses the word ulqiya, which philologically means to be thrown down. This is different from bowing down or sitting down. It refers to this matter, that these wizards were so influenced by the miracle of Moses that all of a sudden they unintentionally and spontaneously fell on the ground. They prostrated because they knew that this issue is not magic and it is a great divine miracle.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Now, continuing the verses, the 47th one says, قَالُوا أَمَنَّا بِرَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. Also the 48th one, رَبِّ مُوسَى وَهَارُونَ. The sorcerer said, we believe in the Lord of the worlds, the Lord of Moses and Aaron. So these sorcerers and magicians, they said, we believe in the Lord of the worlds. But in order to clarify any doubt, in order to prevent Pharaoh from interpreting this sentence according to his own will, they added and said, the Lord of Moses and Aaron, not you, Pharaoh. This shows that although Moses did speak to wizards and performed throwing the staff, his brother Aaron was accompanying him and he was ready to help him in any way possible. And because they were experts in their magician, they were experts in wizardry, they knew that this is something beyond magic and it can be only divine miracle. That's why after this strange change that happened in the wizard's morale, they came out of absolute darkness, and in a short moment, they stepped into a dazzling brightness. They turned their backs on all benefits and advantages they expected Pharaoh. It was easy for them to expose their life to danger because they could differentiate the truth from falseness, and they resorted to the truth because of their new knowledge. They did not pave the rest of the path by the foot of intellect. They continued their path by the power of love. They wanted to mount on the fine mount of love. They were really devoted. They could encounter any danger at that moment. And they were ready to go through the punishments. We will see that for this very reason, they heroically resisted all Pharaoh's threats. The Holy Prophet ﷺ has said, every heart is at the mercy of Allah, the Beneficent. If He wills, He will guide it. And if He wills, He will mislead it. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. I humbly and earnestly advise the Muslim community to follow the infallible Imams and the political, social, economic, and military teachings and culture of these great guides to humanity with devotion, sincerity, and sacrifice. I would like to enjoin all of you to safeguard and observe the fiqh-e-sunnati, traditional jurisprudence, or religious canons. These set forth the schools of prophetic mission and emanate and guarantee the growth and development of the nations through their primary and secondary decrees, both of which are the schools of Islamic jurisprudence.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the resurrection and the hereafter. In one of his speeches, he is talking about the state that we have, and he mentions that each act we perform here has two states: purgatory and a heavenly state, and we shall encounter it. Now, he is referring to two important states which we will definitely see after the death. And the first state is purgatory state, which is known as barzakh as well, a state in between this world and hereafter. And the people
after the death, they are waiting for the hereafter in this state. And in this state, even we have a temporary heaven and a temporary hell.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi, sallallahu alayhi.
Philosophers and the Islamic scholars and even the Islamic texts refers to the state of barzakh as well. And it is said that whatever we do, whatever we perform, we will face it right after the death. The body, the soul, when it leaves this body, it directly and straightforward after leaving this body faces the state of purgatory, where there is a temporary heaven and there is a temporary hell. And after that, we have a heavenly state, which is referred to what we're going to have in hereafter. Therefore, we must be careful about our actions, because whatever we perform, even if someone, for example, has helped anyone and he passes away, for example, as soon as he passes away, if the action that he has performed had the positive impacts on the society, on others, and it has spread the goodness, he will see that, he will enjoy after the death. On the other hand, if he has performed something which is known as a bad action, and this bad action will be something which he will see the consequences for it. Therefore, we must get ready for both things. And we have many narrations which talks about the first night in the grave, when a person is buried in the first night. And that is the worst night. That is the worst time, where the angels comes and they ask the questions and answers. Therefore, we must be careful, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say La ilaha
Insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the war in Ukraine with TV correspondent Johnny Miller. But first, this brief analysis.
It is said that the first victim of war is the truth. And this seems to be especially the case as it relates to the war in Ukraine. Very rarely have the global consumers of Western media been subjected to such a high level of propaganda, ridiculously pro-Ukrainian and viciously anti-Russian, in line with NATO objectives. Western news outlets have taken upon themselves to basically be the public relations arm of NATO. The level of public shaming and gaslighting of experts, academics, and journalists in the media is so intense that there are virtually no Western politicians courageous enough to publicly disagree with the warmongering and hype. Not to mention the fact that right at the beginning of the war, all Russian media were banned in the West by the Western champions of liberal democracy and free speech, lest the so-called wrong facts get transmitted to Western citizens and mess up NATO's plans for a long, attritional war with Russia. In this environment, Press TV has tried to conduct fair reporting by reporting the facts from both sides, some of which expose the lies and false narratives being propagated by Western media in their zeal to be of service to Western military and security organizations. Press TV correspondent Johnny Miller reported the facts as he saw it, including crimes committed by the neo-Nazi elements of the Ukrainian military, as well as reports that paint a somewhat different picture of the mood and morale among Ukrainian civilians than the rosy caricature often portrayed in Western media. Johnny Miller's reward for his excellent journalistic effort is that he was placed on a so-called kill list of Ukrainian neo-Nazis, which includes personal information and encourages people to murder the people on the list, an Italian journalist already falling victim to this outrage. The evil combination of neo-Nazi fanatics being sponsored by the suit and tie-wearing terrorists of NATO make it very difficult to discuss and possibly find a peaceful solution to this devastating war. The comedian president of Ukraine seems to have realized that there will not be a military victory in the cards for Ukraine against Russia. But he might also be in too deep with his neo-Nazi NATO cabal to be able to do anything other than what he's ordered to do. Otherwise, he too might one day end up on the Ukrainian neo-Nazi kill list.
Johnny Miller, thank you for joining us on Insight. I want to spend our time today talking about the war in Ukraine. As you know, our program, we try to look at the historic, the strategic context of the news that we witness on a daily basis, something that unfortunately is no longer there in Western media, in mainstream media. But before we get to that, you know, the rule in journalism is that the journalist should never himself or herself become the story. But unfortunately, it seems that some people don't play by those rules. And it seems, unfortunately, that they put your name on this so-called kill list. It's even nasty to even say it, but unfortunately, that seems to be what has happened. We shouldn't act like nations don't have their own national interests. We shouldn't act like because there was European integration, because there is this kind of solidarity within the Western countries, that somehow, you know, whatever is in America's interest is also in Germany's interest, or whatever is in America's interest is also in Sweden or Britain's interest. Of course, you said, you know, I'm going to out myself as a Scottish nationalist, so I would say the Scots don't have to worry about the oil. They have enough oil and gas for themselves. But a place like Germany, obviously, is a major problem if they can't have normal relations with Russia, because their entire industry, it's not only oil and gas, it's aluminum, it's various raw materials that are the basis of this mighty German, you know, industrial system that exists there. So yeah, I think maybe the story, and this is good when we have these kind of conversations, we get to some new insight, which is the point of our program, is that maybe, like you said, this is going to have a much more devastating effect on these Western European countries who are. And again, I think we should distinguish between the people and the elites. I think most people in Europe are keenly aware of that this is just wrong. Yes, they might not, they don't agree with Russian invasion. They sympathize with the Ukrainian people. It's not that they are on the Russian side, but they realize that it is not in their interest to become this kind of, you know, cannon fodder for NATO or America's, you know, imperial plans or strategic plans.
I don't know about that. I mean, I'll tell you when I go back to London. I haven't been there for a while. But before I went, I mean, there seems to be the propaganda. Noam Chomsky and John Pilger said a couple of weeks ago that since the Vietnam War, all these years they've been imposing, they've never seen the propaganda like in this war, in any else. And I think it's largely working. I mean, I'll get back to you when I go back to London. But there seems to be, as I said, no serious debate about NATO's involvement of this whitewashing of the extremists. And I expect this propaganda is having a huge effect. I mean, now Ukraine is largely off the news, I think. It was big for the first month. Now it's largely off it. So I do wonder, actually, just how many people know much about Ukraine. But I think what you will see, of course, is the further gas prices go up and food prices go up, and the further that's linked to Ukraine, which is a big part of why they're going up,
exactly.
Then, of course, I think people, for their own self-interest, might start to wonder, why are we in Ukraine? And then you may well see more reporting about the kind of stuff that I'm reporting on. But if you see policy-making change, you may well see some of the journalists being sent to East Ukraine and Donbass and starting to tell the whole story. Well, you know, maybe there are some pro-Russian people there, or maybe there are some extremists. Maybe we shouldn't be sending weapons. Maybe we should push for peace. So you might see the media narrative change if you see the policy, government policy change.
Well, you know, I think this is an interesting thing we can speculate about, which is that there's a desperate attempt, it seems to me, by NATO, which is basically an American military organization. I mean, it's true, it has all these different countries that are in it, but everybody knows that it's, you know, basically America's military coalition that it can command to do whatever it wants. It seems to me that the defeat in Afghanistan was really something that was an existential problem for these people. They had come in and said that, you know, NATO is going to be, Afghanistan is going to be the great project that proves that NATO is still relevant after the Cold War, after the demise of the Soviet Union. And after 20 years, you know, it was just shambles. It was just a mess, as we all remember the way that they fled from Kabul. And it seems to me, and, you know, I think I have reason to be cynical and not have a good view of Western elites and not be optimistic about that they want good for themselves and for their own people, based on what we've seen from them. I think there was an idea that, hey, you know what, we're going to revive NATO here, we're going to give it a new sort of life, we're going to try to, you know, make it relevant and keep it relevant, maybe bring in some new people. You know, you got Sweden and Russia, Sweden and Finland talking about doing these things, which is very strange. Sweden and Finland were historically always neutral. Even during the Cold War, they were not part of NATO, which was probably more threatening than we have today. You know, Russia, it's very unlikely Russia is going to attack Finland or Sweden. I mean, it's almost, you know, you know, it's virtually impossible that they would do that. So I think we can't underestimate the level to which they're going to desperately try to keep this going, even if the people in the West don't want it to go on. We saw it with the Iraq War.
I think you're right with the difference between the elites and the people. We're seeing that many examples of it. Increasingly, elites just don't seem to care about the people's living standards. But they may well care more about this grand policy. There's one of the propaganda debates about in this war has been what have Russia's aims been? The West likes to say that Russia tried to take Kiev, failed. So it's this great big victory from Ukraine. I was in Kiev at the start of the war.
Please tell us about it.
So the Russian troops were surrounded Kiev, not entirely surrounded. They allowed people to get in and out through a train route. But there was hardly any strikes, maybe four or five strikes. If you're going to try to take Kiev, it's clear that Russia's aims are to take over the pro-Russian areas of Ukraine. I think Russia may well have learned their lesson from the Afghanistan in the 90s, or indeed the Americans in Afghanistan. The Americans were in Afghanistan for 20 years, and now who's back in power? The Taliban. It's very hard for a country to rule or take over a country when you have a hostile population. Russia is trying to take over the Donbass region, the southern region, Crimea, of course, annexed 8 years ago. And right. The vast majority of people in Crimea are Russian, so they have no internal problems.
Yeah, I mean, Khrushchev, who was Ukrainian, gave it to the Ukraine during his rule in the Soviet Union.
Sure. Donbass is the vast majority Russian, so where I was in Donbass, Russia doesn't have any problems controlling those territories. In the southern region, just above Crimea, that's more complicated. Right. Russia's taken that area in order to safeguard Crimea. Crimea, of course, crucial for their geopolitics. They can control the Black Sea from there, which is very important to them. I was in that area. There it's a lot more mixed. I went to the streets. I interviewed a dozen groups of people. About 25% of those people, I'd say, were openly pro-Russian. 25% were openly pro-Ukrainian, although some of them asking to see my British press credentials before answering because they're worried about the authorities. Right. But interesting, about 50% of the people said they've got Russian family, Ukrainian family, and they just want peace.
Right.
Now, since the Russians took over that area, you may well have seen more Ukrainians leave, mm-hmm. And so it's become more of a pro-Russian area. But there's also terrorist attacks or insurgent attacks by Ukrainians. So it's much more mixed. If Russia was to take over the rest of Kiev or the Western Kiev, it would be very hard for them to control that in the long term. Just that the Americans found out in Afghanistan. Very hard for them to do that with a hostile population. And so it's not Russia's desire to do that. But my fear is that the Americans may well want that to happen. They want to drag Russia into a long war here. So if you keep arming Ukraine, Russia's, and it's openly said it, it's going to have to go further. And so that's why you might see this war drag on for years, rather than anybody suing for peace. For a long-term NATO strategy to try and drag Russia into a new Afghanistan, if you will. Russia's invasion of Afghanistan in the 80s is largely attributed to bring down the Soviet Union. And I think that's what NATO's plan is here as well, to bring Russia in to a new Afghanistan. And that's why Russia wants to keep to the pro-Russian areas, but they may well be forced to go further by NATO.
So you don't see any signs within Ukraine, I'm talking about the Ukrainian side, not the Russian speakers or the ethnic Russians, on the Ukrainian side of them wanting to somehow get to a peace agreement or some sort of end of hostilities?
So the Russian side or the Ukrainian side?
The Ukrainian side.
On the Ukrainian side, I think the people, once again, you ask the people, I'd be fascinated if you did a referendum in Ukraine today, either including the pro-Russian areas or not including the pro-Russian areas. If you did a referendum in Ukraine before the Russian invasion started, you asked the Ukrainian people, would you be happy to give away Crimea and Donbass, or there's going to be a Russian invasion? I think we'd be very interested in the answer to that. I think most people in Ukraine, this I'm just speculating, but I do have some contacts there. For Crimea and Donbass, pro-Russian areas, you know, most Ukrainians, as long as they're not ultra-nationalists, would say, let's just let them have that. But then you've got this area above Crimea, which is more complicated. Many Ukrainians saying, well, we give them Crimea and Donbass, but what about this area, Kherson, for example, which may well have been majority Ukrainian before Russia got involved. So that's when it becomes a lot more complicated. But if you ask the Ukrainian people now, do you want to negotiate for peace, even if it means ceding territory? I think the majority, I think, would say yes. But that's why you have the government and the nationalists who are very much pushing for. I mean, as a journalist here in Ukraine, I spend a lot of time on the Telegram channels. Okay, that's a new sort of way of journalism. You have to spend a lot of time on the Telegram channels of soldiers and civilians posting videos from the front lines or posting videos of what's going on the streets of West Ukraine. I can't tell you how many videos I saw of conscription officers of the Ukrainian military going into beaches, going on the streets, literally chasing Ukrainian citizens to hand them out conscription notices. You have the old men of military age, 18 to 60, are not allowed to leave the country. They're effectively prisoners in the country and increasingly being forced to fight. And when they do join up, they've hardly got any military experience, being sent to the front line with almost no weapons. Once again, I can't tell you how many videos I've seen of Ukrainian soldiers with their whole company behind them, reading out a statement to President Zelensky saying, you sent us here with no weapons, we don't want to fight, we refuse to fight, we're going home, essentially. I can't tell you how many videos I've seen of that. You don't see any of that in Western media, by the way.
Yeah, very interesting. None of that is in Western media. It's all this kind of propaganda, you know.
It's incredible. I did one story about it, I think. But I can't say how many videos I've seen. And these are Ukrainians posting it. So it's not propaganda. These are Ukrainian soldiers posting these videos to President Zelensky. And I've seen countless numbers of them. And the Western media just says Ukrainian morale is sky high. It's not sky high. It may be sky high amongst some of the nationalists or the people at the back. But against and it's poor people who are sent to these front lines, mainly. Forced to fight, sent to the front lines, and hundreds at one stage, I'm not sure about the numbers now, one stage hundreds were dying every day under Russian artillery. It's an absolute slaughter. This is mainly a proxy war now. So Ukrainian people are being used as cannon fodder for an American proxy war in Ukraine. And it's shocking. And so many people still in the West say, stand for Ukraine. Both standing for Ukraine, continuing to send them weapons, is literally sending them in to die.
Absolutely.
And I can't believe how there's not more people pushing for a peaceful negotiated settlement. And one of the reasons there's not is because of the level of propaganda. And also the propaganda making Russia out to be evil, not just evil government, but evil people. Absolutely. They must be stopped. They're going to invade Eastern Europe. Russia's not going to invade Eastern Europe unless it's pushed to. It's trying to take over Crimea because that's what's important to them and throw Russian areas. But the level of propaganda in order to keep sending money to Ukraine so more Ukrainians die, it's shocking.
Okay, Johnny, so let's talk about the future a little bit, because, I mean, it's pretty bleak what's going on right now, both in terms of what's happening in the Ukraine and the areas where there's conflict, but also, as we were talking, also what's happening to the public in Western Europe and the political and the social environment that we have, this kind of, you know, suffocating, you know, propaganda. So let's try to look to the future a little bit. So let's start with what you were just talking about, which is the idea that maybe it's not sustainable for the Ukrainians to continue much longer. And, you know, everything I've seen from the Russian side points to the fact that they are willing to compromise if they can get, you know, in terms of having the independence of those Donbass republics and Crimea. So if you could give us a little insight on that.
I think don't think Russia's interested in negotiations at the moment either, because essentially if NATO continues to send them weapons, increasingly very high-tech, high-powered weapons that can hit Donetsk or hit Crimea, then Russia doesn't really see a point in negotiating. It's said clearly that if NATO keeps sending these weapons and threatening our cities, we're just going to have to take more of Ukraine. You've got the major cities of Kharkiv and Odessa. I've asked frequently Russian journalists or politicians, do they want to take these cities? Kharkiv and Odessa do have large Russian minorities in them. So if they were to take these cities, with the amount of Ukrainians that flee, they could well be able to control them in the long term. It wouldn't be like Kiev, where the overwhelming population is hostile. So they might want to take these cities as well. But if NATO continues to send weapons to Ukraine, I think Russia will just continue to fight. And maybe that's NATO's aim. Do NATO politicians really care about the death of Ukrainian people or the destruction of Ukrainian cities? If there were hundreds of British or American soldiers dying every single day in Ukraine, you'd have absolute outcry about it. But there's no outcry in Britain because they're Ukrainians. It doesn't really matter to them.
Well, do you think the Ukrainian government can sustain it? I mean, obviously, well, we know that the NATO doesn't care about the Ukrainians, but does it reach a point where the Zelensky government is no longer able to continue this?
Well, you've just had in the last few days a purge by Zelensky of very important figures. I think the head of the SBU, a former friend of his, has been kicked out. Some other high-ranking figures. So we're not quite sure why this is. The Americans have also just warned about Zelensky's security. Some analysts have said the Americans essentially threatened him.
Right.
And this is increasingly, you expect to see much more repression in Ukraine. And this is all part of, we started this conversation talking about a kill list. Well, in Ukrainian society, it's basically impossible to criticize the government or to criticize the nationalists because it's so dangerous there. So you're going to see so much more repression in Ukraine, forcing people to do what the government says. I also can't tell you how many videos I've seen online of women in Ukraine standing up to these conscription officers or posting their own videos saying you're taking our men to the front line.
Correct.
And I'm seeing increasingly angry video posts, particularly from women in Ukraine as well, and men, just saying this, we can't keep sustaining this. So you ask a good question of whether Ukraine can keep sustaining it. I think the NATO has so much control over Ukraine. I mean, NATO could change the Ukrainian government whenever it wanted. They fund and arm the Ukrainians. They basically control.
So do you think it would be correct to say that is it related to the person of Zelensky, or is it not that important whether he remains or he goes?
I don't think it's that important. I mean, Zelensky isn't an ultra-nationalist. But I mean, I actually think he's quite a decent guy, to be honest with you. Before he became president, he did a famous interview in which he said, just let the pro-Russians speak Russian. Just let them do it. Why do we have to force them not to? He did a lot of work in stopping corruption or helping to stop corruption before the Russian invasion. So I think Zelensky's quite a decent guy. He's a moderate guy. but he doesn't really have much power here. You've got the Americans on one side and the ultra-nationalists on the other, and he's caught in the middle, having to do whatever he's told, frankly. So you may well see more purges or maybe a change of government, but NATO is clearly determined to keep this war going on as long as possible. But as you say, there may well be a breaking point at some point in which the Ukrainians simply can't sustain it. But whether this war is going to last another few months or, I mean, Afghanistan lasted 20 years, so that's my fear.
Well, you know, I think you're right. I mean, I don't think it's going to be 20 years. It might be maybe a year or two. But the way I see it, that, you know, Russia is not crumbling. All the sanctions haven't worked. They've actually backfired on the West. Russia is doing okay. You know, it's not under pressure. You saw we recently had President Putin and President Erdogan come to Tehran for the big summit about Syria. So it doesn't seem to be that the Western policy, the Western strategy has been working against Russia. Tell us what the mood is. You're across the border. What is the mood in Russia on all this issue?
Yeah, before going to Donbass. The Russians, of course, call this a special military operation. Well, for people in Russia, this does very much feel like a special military operation on the edges of the empire, if you like. It's not really affecting Russian people all that much. Yes, the sanctions are damaging. Certainly some people who work in trade with the West, for example.
All right. So listen, Johnny, I want to conclude with going back to the West a little bit. And, you know, I want to also commend you and say thank you. You deserve some rest. You were in very difficult situations. You are now going to spend a little time resting. But before we end our conversation, let's go back to the West. We talked about the future in Ukraine. You talked about how in Russia it's not really affecting daily life. And we also talked about, you know, the idea that maybe the Europeans miscalculated. Do you feel that there is a chance, an opportunity, that there would be a movement in Western countries? Of course, each country is different. We don't want to generalize. Where you could see people, you know, starting to protest about this and trying to get this to end, because it seems it's going to have a bad effect on them, especially when it gets colder. And when, you know, they start feeling the problems in terms of prices and the effects it has on their daily life.
Well, the Russian media likes to make out that all these Western leaders are falling now with Boris Johnson, the Italian, and they like to think that it's all because of Ukraine. I think maybe some of it is. I do point out to a Russian journalist that Boris Johnson is scandal after domestic scandal, and that's the major reason he's fallen. But I think particularly when you see winter coming, and gas prices going up so much, I think you may well see a lot of people start saying, is this war really worth it? And increasingly politicians, particularly German, French, Emmanuel Macron is still on the phone to Putin all the time. Russia and Germany do have relations with Russia. So I think winter, you may well see an opportunity for European countries to say, look, we're not having any more of this. And without Russian and without French and German support, can the Americans and Brits go alone in Ukraine and arming Ukraine? I'm not sure. But I think maybe when winter comes, you may well see another opportunity, if you like, for particularly European countries to question whether their continued support of Ukraine militarily rather than pushing for peace is really the right option for the European people.
Press TV correspondent Johnny Miller, thank you so much for joining us. I know you were tired, but you took the time to have a conversation with us. Thank you very much. Get some rest. Stay safe. And looking forward to more of your excellent reporting.
Thank you so much. And we're also going to open the window. It's got so hot in here. So that's the first thing I want to do. But thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Johnny Miller? The reality on the ground in Ukraine is very different than what is being portrayed in Western media. It is virtually impossible to rationally discuss this war and to suggest that NATO or Ukraine are partially to blame for what is happening. NATO's aggressive expansion eastwards following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the existential threat that this poses to the Russian homeland are rarely discussed. It seems that NATO was itching for a war with Russia, no matter what, and as the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, mentioned in his meeting with President Putin in Tehran, NATO would have eventually used the excuse of the Crimea to start a war with Russia. To understand this ingrained Russophobia among Western elites, we have to go back to the end of the 19th century and British imperial strategists such as Halford Mackinder, who claimed that if Britain wants to rule the world, it has to rule Eastern Europe, West Asia, and Eurasia in general. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss about the problems, questions, and issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Professor Salman Nakavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Professor Salman Nakavi is a faculty member at the Al Mustafa University and also a researcher on the Islamic issues in the Hawza Ilmi Afkum. Well, in our last session, we reached the conclusion that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when He blesses parents with a child, it's an honor, it's a dignity, and child is an amana, it's a trust given to those parents. Now, how these parents can act as educators or trainers or life guiders for this child?
So, yes, exactly that was what we wanted to say, that the worldview, the mindset has to be developed. They have to understand all of this. As I said, with this mindset of the unity of Allah Almighty in mind.
Yeah.
If that is not there, we cannot think of carrying out our practices and acts and behavior that we carry out on a daily basis for the sake of Allah.
All right.
The moment we want to say, oh, when if we will become spiritual when we go to pray, but we don't have anything to do with spirituality when we want to deal with our children. No.
Okay.
That tawheed, that understanding of monotheism has to permeate all the aspects of our lives. So when we're dealing with children, that's also with this mindset that this is for the sake of Allah.
All right.
For the sake of proximity to Allah. For the sake of carrying out things which are important according to Allah and which have to be taken care of. That I want to give unto this world some a human being who is worthy of being called a human being.
Yeah.
Worthy of being called the manifestation of Allah's will.
Yeah.
And a sign of Allah Almighty in the true sense, an embodiment of Allah's attributes. So I myself have to prepare myself to become a good educator for him, a good role model for him or her. So I have to manage I have to be able, as we were saying before, that we should be able to manage the various relations that we have.
Ourselves
and become a good role model. We have to increase our knowledge, number one, about the whole scheme of things, as I said.
Okay.
And where we fall into that scheme, where do we fall?
Yeah.
What is our position as a human being and as a parent, especially?
Okay.
And then a parent and as an educator should know where he's starting from. and where he wants to take his child to, which destination, which, as we said, the starting point, ending point.
Yeah.
The starting point, the behavior, when a child comes into this world, of course, he hasn't got, as you said, he's a clean slate.
Yeah.
So he's starting from zero.
Yeah.
Allah Almighty says, وَاللَّهُ أَخْرَجَكُمْ مِنْ بُطُونِ أُمَّهَاتِكُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ شَيْئًا. That Allah Almighty has brought you forward, brought you forth into this world out of the wombs of your mothers, and you don't know anything.
Yeah.
You're a clean slate.
Sure.
And the destiny that is there, the goal which is there in front of you, it is infinite.
True.
Reaching Allah,